This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight, public television begins a three-part series called The Irish in America, Long Journey Home. America is a country of immigrants, and the Irish, who were escaping the potato famine of the 1840s, were the first to arrive here in large numbers, poor and hungry. The anti-immigration movement of today has its roots in the anti-Irish sentiment of the mid-1800s. The TV series and its companion book follow the Irish in America, the discrimination they faced, and the institutions they helped build that transformed America. My guest Peter Quinn is one of the people interviewed for the series, and he's a contributor to the companion book. His novel, The Banished Children of Eve, is about the Irish in New York City during the Civil War. Three of Quinn's grandparents were from rural Ireland. The schools he attended while growing up in the Bronx were founded by the Irish who arrived here during the famine.
I spent a large part of my life groping back to my own roots in the Irish famine. My first ancestor arrived in New York in 1847, Michael Manning, as a dispossessed Irish farmer. And we eventually, after 50 years on the Lower East Side, moved to the Bronx and the great New York immigration upwards and out. And then in 1970, I was a Vista volunteer in Kansas City, intending to go to California and shake off the dust of the Bronx and New York from my feet forever. But it was at that point that I turned around and began to wonder about the whole experience of my family, about where we had come from. I had the sense I'm at the end of a long process, and I didn't know what the process was about. So that I eventually came back to New York and went to Fordham University in the Bronx to get a graduate degree in Irish history to begin to explore this whole experience, which I knew very, very little about.
What did you think it meant to be Irish before you started doing a lot of research about Irish history?
Well, it was a very simple definition when I was growing up in the Bronx. It was you voted Democratic and went to Mass. To be Catholic and Democratic was the essence of being Irish. I never heard in my family, we were not talking about Yeats and Joyce and the Irish Renaissance. I never heard my parents mention their names.
Well, you know, you've mentioned in one of your articles that your family never seemed to have any artifacts or memorabilia or anything left over from Ireland. And in fact, none of the kids who you know had families that had anything remaining from their lives in Ireland. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Well, anybody I knew from the famine immigration, whose family had come in the 1840s, they didn't have, I don't even have a village name, really. There was no stick of furniture. There were no artifacts or relics or things passed down from one generation to the other. There were barely any stories passed down from one generation to the other. And when I began to go back, you know, the famine experience had been, it's so central to the Irish psyche, to who the Irish are today on both sides of the Atlantic. And I began to see that there was this, you know, where had it gone? Where had the experience gone?
What do you think that was? Do you think it was, like, so painful people wanted to forget about it? I'm reminded, for instance, I think in a lot of Jewish families that came from Eastern Europe, you know, you don't talk about the old country.
Yeah, there was the necessity of getting on. Just, I don't think it was a conscious decision, well, let's erase history, but it was the circumstances that people were under. They weren't educated. We're talking about the lowest economic levels of Irish society that wound up crowded together in American cities. It was a matter of survival. And I also think it was not something parents were passing on to their children. There was a great humiliation of the Irish that went on the famine. They couldn't feed themselves, and the British government at some point decided that the best thing would be to clear the land, that the famine would become an instrument of social engineering, that there could be no economic progress in Ireland unless these people were cleared away. The whole journey off the land, many cases of evicted, into ships where they were mistreated, into cities where they were hated, you know, this is not something that becomes part of the folk memory where you're passing it on and saying, you should remember this.
You know, it's interesting. I think now Americans think of the Irish, of Irish Catholics, as being, you know, white Americans. And what's distinctive about it? But there was a time when the Irish came here and they were seen as very different and very inferior and very much to be hated.
Well, I think it's almost impossible for us. I remember going to California and giving a talk about my book and explaining this perception of the Irish Catholic. I mean, you're talking about a Northern European white Christian ethnic group in the 19th century who were regarded as racially different from the rest of America. Now, that's almost hard to believe, but Irish Catholics were perceived not as a kind of different religious group. They were perceived racially, that, you know, they were racial characteristics. You have Charles Loring Brace, the founder of the Children Aid Society in New York, and he writes a book in 1863 called Races of the Old World, and he talks about Irish skull size, brain size, that their brain was between that of an Englishman and an African. It seems almost laughable now, but, you know, we have the bell curve. We've transferred the measurement from measuring people's, the size of their cranium, to these absolute standards, supposedly, of IQ. But they always come up with the same result, that the poorest levels of society are not as bright as the richest levels of society. That's what, the iron rule of intelligence testing.
Do you think another thing that kind of aroused the fears of people in America toward the Irish was that there were so many of them coming at the same time, like... They're going to take over. They're going to change the complexion of the United States.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, I don't want to just say that the people who reacted to the Irish were just making it all up. You had this sudden descent of rural people unprepared for urban life on American cities. Really, you have all these consequences of it: poverty, violence. The essence of city life in American cities changes. In 1847, Boston's a city of 100,000 people. You have 30,000 people arrive in 1 year. So that they did change the nature of American cities. They did add all these different elements. You really have two parallel, I think, experiences in American history where that happens. The African-American immigration to northern cities and the Irish immigration. There are a lot of similarities between those two events. They do change the nature of American cities.
When the Irish came to the United States after the famine, there were no self-help groups in place for them. There were no government programs to ease their transition to American cities. They had to help each other. What are some of the ways that they had of doing that, some of the groups that they built to help each other?
One of the groups that they built at the foundation of the United States is the American labor movement. Right away, they're organizing unions in cities, and they don't have an experience of entrepreneurial capitalism. They're not so-called entrepreneurs. They're not shopkeepers. The villages they come from don't have shops. They don't have this business tradition. They have the tradition of sticking together, which rapidly translates into unions. They also, with the Catholic institutions, the start of orphanages, the Foundling Hospital in New York, the Catholic Protectory, which in Westchester, which is now part of the Bronx, there's a movement in American society. One of the things called the placing out system, which begins in 1857, when they begin to take children, when children are brought to the courts, they're taken from their homes and sent west in these orphan trains, which go on for years and years. And in the beginning of these orphan trains, they're almost all Irish-American. And it's really Catholic nuns who began to organize against that in New York City and to start these orphanages and asylums that Catholic children will be tended for in their own institutions. And it's these Catholic nuns who eventually, working with Irish politicians, begin to demand that there be support by the state for institutions for the poor.
How did the Irish become so identified with the Democratic Party?
The Republican Party tended to be the party of business and individualism. The Democratic Party, because of its position in the cities, some Democratic bosses like Fernando Wood in New York City was the first person to realize that, you know, these people have the vote. Also, the Democratic Party adopted the position of pro-immigration. There were members of the Republican Party, like the governor of New York, Governor Seward, who he toyed with the idea. He wanted to get the Republican Party to become more pro-immigration and try to attract the Irish, but that's not what happened.
I think the schools that you went to as a boy in the Bronx were schools that were started by the Irish who came after the potato famine.
The parish I'm from, St. Raymond's on Tremont Avenue, was started in 1848 and was a direct consequence of the Irish potato famine.
So did you feel like, in retrospect, that a lot of the institutions around you when you were growing up related to the famine, to the people who came from the famine?
I came to understand that the institutions that formed, and we all tend to think that the institutions have always been there. And as I began this exploration of my own background, I was fascinated by the fact of the dates of the start of these schools that I had gone to, that I was being taught, really, by institutions founded with the attitudes, with the sensibilities of the famine Irish. 120 years later, it hadn't gone away. It was still there. It still had a presence and effect that I had never been able to judge before or realize.
My guest is Peter Quinn. He's a contributor to the book The Irish in America and the companion PBS series, which begins tonight. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Peter Quinn, one of the experts interviewed in the PBS series The Irish in America, which begins tonight. Well, you know, the biggest cliche about the Irish is that it's a drinking culture. You know, even like what's an Irish dinner, a six-pack and a potato or something?
A seven-course Irish dinner is a boiled potato and a six-pack.
There you go, right. Thank you. Anyways, but how did that become the stereotype, drinking in the Irish saloons as the big gathering place? I should mention here, I think your grandfather owned a saloon.
my grandfather owned a saloon on 11th Street in Dry Dock, which is now Shoal Place in Lower Manhattan. The effect of alcohol on the Irish, part of it was the anesthetizing themselves against the pain that they went through. In the 19th century America, just a simple example, canal workers used to be given a ration of whiskey every day because the work was so brutal. And that was a part of the Irish experience of the trauma of Irish history. You know, the self-medical help that alcohol is. The way the poor today, you know, with drug abuse, I don't think it's much different. But there's another element to saloon life in Irish culture, which is this accent on the Irish on sociability, on talk, on music. And that the saloon was that, too. It just wasn't a place to drink. It was a labor bureau. It was a social club. It was a place where people talked, where politics was done. Almost all the ward healers in New York, and probably Chicago too, although I'm not from Chicago, were saloon keepers. They didn't have these other fraternal organizations. They didn't have these high-class clubs. They had the saloon, which is where they met and talked and sang and carried all these social habits that had existed in the Irish villages, the clachan in Ireland. One of the things I think the Irish are the first immigrant group to do, and this has been done since by other immigrant groups, is they recreate the village and the city. They just don't come to cities and disappear and become lost and disoriented. They are like that when they arrive, but they quickly organize the village in the city, the parish and the saloon. When I was growing up in the Bronx, nobody ever said they were from the Bronx or Metropolitan Avenue or Kingsbridge. They were from a parish. You were from St. John's. St. Nicholas of Tallentine, St. Helena's, St. Raymond's. That's how you identified yourself. And to an extent, people still do that.
What do you know about your grandfather's saloon?
I know that my grandmother wanted him to get out of it, that she didn't. She said there was never an honest dollar made across a bar, and that he didn't make a lot of money at it, unfortunately, and that in a act of business astuteness, which my family has always been good at, he sold the real estate he owned in Manhattan and moved to the Bronx. So I'm still have a day job because of that kind of forward thinking.
Really?
But my father was in politics. My father was a judge in New York. And his ambition for my brother and I was to get civil service jobs. That was the great accent in Irish families. My family wasn't alone in that. And in parochial schools, too. You know, there was one of the consequences of the famine, one of the consequences of this absolute lack of any security was this almost obsession with it, that I had a BA from college, and my father, I took the court officer's test in New York, and I became a court officer, and I went up to his chambers, and I said, I want to leave and go back and go to graduate school. And he said, you never leave a civil service job. You stay in the civil service job and get the pension, then you do whatever you want, but you never leave a civil service job. And that sense of security was a very prevalent part of Irish urban experience, of seeking security, of ensuring you or your family will never starve again.
And how did you explain to him that you were leaving the civil service job?
Well, I hate to admit this at my maturity, but I didn't explain to him. I stayed until he died.
Really?
Yeah. He died in 1974. I had this conversation with him in 1972. I said, I want to go back to graduate school and study Irish history, and he said, that's when he told me, absolutely not, you never leave a civil service job. And when he died 2 years later, I quit the civil service job.
Had you stayed out of respect for him or out of trust in his opinion?
Both. You know, his father had seen the tail end of the famine in Tipperary, and then my father lived through the Great Depression. And he would always tell a story to my brother and me when we were boys of being in Foley Square and seeing 3,000 men lined up to take the court officer's test. That part of what he, the stories he had been told about the famine, he had transferred to the Depression. That, you know, so there was not a and there was not a lot of accent in Irish families, at least any that I knew, about going out into the business world. My father and his father kind of regarded it as a very suspect activity.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Quinn, and he's written about Irish history in America in his novel, The Banished Children of Eve. He's a contributor to the new book, The Irish in America, which is a companion to the new PBS series called The Long Journey Home, The Irish in America, and he's one of the people interviewed for that PBS series. Your novel, The Banished Children of Eve, which came out a few years ago, is about a really interesting but very obscure for most people chapter in American history that has to do with the draft during the Civil War. Tell us a little bit about this, because I think most people really don't know about these draft riot.
Well, the granddaddy of all American riots to this day is the draft riots in New York in July 1863. Three times as many people died in the draft riots in New York in 1863 as in Los Angeles in 1992. It remains the single greatest instance of American urban violence. It spread all across the city. The police lost control of it. The militia lost control of it. Finally, they had to bring the regiments back from Gettysburg, and they fought pitched battles in the New York streets on 2nd Avenue and 3rd Avenue, not far from here. They had cannons lined up. If you look at the lithographs, it looks like the Battle of the Paris Commune. It was an extraordinary event in American history.
What was it about?
It was about the imposition of the military draft that had happened in the first time in American history that the government said, we're not going to just rely on volunteers, that we're going to draft people. And they created two exemptions to the draft. One was you could send a substitute in your place and be excused from any further drafts, or you could pay $300 and send a substitute, and that would excuse you from that round of the draft. In the Irish slums of New York and in other places, $300 was a working wage for a year. And you're dealing with the people only 8 years away from the end of the famine immigration. You're dealing with this mass of people who arrived in the eastern cities of the United States who perceive the Anglo-American aristocracy that was here as the same aristocracy they had dealt with in Ireland. It's almost impossible to understand the draft riots outside the context of Irish history, especially the date that it starts. It starts on July 13th, which is the day after Orangeman's Day, which was a day of great violence and still is in Northern Ireland, and a significant date in Irish history.
So the poor Irish were angry at this draft law, which said that people who had more money than they did could get out of the draft.
Yes.
Or people who had more connections than they did could get out of the draft.
Yes.
And did they not also want to fight for a country that they just landed in and they were at the very bottom of?
Well, large numbers of the Irish did fight. There was the Irish Brigade, which had a regiment from New York. The Irish fought in large numbers in the Union Army. But there was also this resentment in the Irish slums in July of 1863. The draft riots they are this social explosion. They are like the Paris Commune in some ways. They're also a race riot. The Irish people in the city turn their anger up to the people next to them, which are African Americans. African Americans are, you know, the oldest ethnic group in New York City with the Dutch, and in many cases the Irish had, because they were so poor, they undercut African Americans in the lowest jobs in the cities. They would work for less. But by the summer of 1863, their perception was, with abolition, we're being drafted to fight to free the slaves, and they're going to come and take our jobs. That was the kind of one of the bottom line resentments of the riots. It's not the end of this in American history. Groups in cities struggling against each other for what's left at the bottom.
You grew up in the Bronx. What's your old neighborhood like now?
My old neighborhood is largely Spanish. The Catholic Church is still there. That's the institution that hasn't gone away. The public school is Spanish. It's another immigrant group replacing the Irish. I remember early on in writing the book, The Banished Children of Eve, I was down on Grand Street, and my ancestors had been at a parish there, St. Mary's, and the church is still there. And I was just kind of curious. I had this, this name of the parish. I had never been in it, and it's an immigrant area. And I went in to the church. It was built in the 1830s. And I went to the Easter services, and I sat there, and there were mostly people from the Dominican Republic, poor people. And I sat in the back of the church, and I said, these people, this is what it looked like in the 1840s. It's not all that different here. It's another language. They were speaking Spanish. They were dressed poorly. They looked different. And, I said, if somebody had wandered in this church 140 years ago, this is what they would have seen. And my great hope, people have said, the book is a story of the banished children, evil violence and rioting and this great urban upheaval. But to me, it gave me a lot of hope. I said, if the famine Irish could go through all this, cause all these problems, survive all this misery, and come out the better for it at the end, and New York City and American society come out stronger because of it, then we have tremendous reason to hope.
Well, Peter Quinn, I really want to thank you a lot.
Okay, thank you.
Peter Quinn is one of the experts featured in the PBS series The Irish in America, which begins tonight and continues Tuesday and Wednesday. He also contributed to the companion book. Quinn's novel about the Irish in New York City during the Civil War is called Banished Children of Eve. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.